Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Troops open fire on protesters in Syria, Yemen, and yes, still in Libya. It's still hard to know where to look first in the Middle East turmoil and democracy movements. Let's try to see what's happening now that really matters through the eyes of Marwan Bishara from Al Jazeera, including a question that we've asked a lot and that he has written about. Has the Western intervention in Libya helped or hurt the democracy movements elsewhere? Marwan Bishara is senior political analyst for Al Jazeera English and host of Empire, a monthly show about global powers. He is in London. Marwan, thanks for coming on. Welcome to WNYC. Hello from New York.
Thank you for having me.
First, can you give our listeners a little background on you? You do this monthly series called Empire, as well as other political analysis. What's your main interest, and what kind of background do you bring?
You know, in Al Jazeera English, since we're covering the world through some 69 correspondents and reporters around the world, the big strategic questions sometimes are missed because of the richness of the details, if you will. And so sometimes we need to distill some of these big strategic questions, especially the ones that have to do with the West and the greater Middle East. And as you know, and as your listeners know all too well, this global Middle Eastern region has been, at least for the last 10, 20 years, the center of attention as well as the center of conflict, so many wars and so on and so forth, notably after the Cold War. And so my role is try to decipher, analyze, and put in perspective some of these bigger movements on the Western Eastern Front.
What's your own country of origin?
I'm Palestinian.
And living in London for many years?
I'm actually still based in where the mothership is, which is Doha, Qatar. Mm-hmm. But Al Jazeera English is based on four different broadcasting centers, we actually broadcast from four different parts of the world: Kuala Lumpur, Washington, London, and Doha. And hence, I'm one of those victims who are based in the broadcasting centers.
I hear you. So, in your opinion, has the Western intervention in Libya helped or hurt the democracy movements elsewhere?
You know, the jury is still out, but the tendency is as follows. The more the conflict in Libya and the military Western intervention in Libya prolongs, the worse it will get for the democratic movement and the rest of the world, simply because, as your listeners know all too well, this region has very fresh memory from decades, in fact, long decades of colonial rule in the Arab region. Libya, before its liberation from the Italian occupation, some put the estimates at between one-third to one-half of its population was wiped out during its liberation from colonialism. And so there is a fresh memory in the Arab world, and the fact that Western military intervention bombardment as such continues in Libya, with probably more pictures and images of more Libyan dead because of that intervention without bringing to an end the Gaddafi regime. That sort of a situation will end up hurting the movement, the authentic movement for freedom and change in the Arab world.
And we just had a guest before you from Afghanistan, maybe you know Malalai Joya, who was making the argument that democracy movements only succeed without outside Western military intervention. And you have written that any outside intervention, even if it happens to fall on the right side of history, robs revolutionaries of sovereignty over their uprising. But do you think that's true in all cases, and particularly in the case of Libya? Does the fact that the Arab League asked for this intervention transform that debate?
You know, if we probably should all try and remind ourselves that the intervention was not required for freedom and democracy. It was required on the basis of protecting people from possible genocide. It was on the eve of Resolution 1973 that Gaddafi threatened what he called those rats that he is going to pursue in every street, every neighborhood, every city, every house, every closet, and that he was going to get each and every one of them, and threatening the second largest city in Libya, Benghazi, with that sort of an assault. So in a sense, the international, and here it's not at all meant to be a Western intervention, an international intervention through the UN Security Council was meant to protect the Libyan people from Gaddafi's onslaught. And I think there is enough ground today in international law, especially international humanitarian law, for questions of right to protect and so on. Whether this was as imminent as some would like to explain it, of course, that remains subject to interpretation. But whether all of that is at all helpful for the larger picture of the movement towards democracy in the rest of the Arab world, that's, of course, a different question altogether.
So what's your political analysis of what's going on in Syria and Yemen right now as it relates to Libya? And for people who haven't been following it, thousands are defying their governments in Syria and Yemen right now, despite being shot at over the weekend. Do you think that would be playing out differently if Gaddafi had been able to massacre people in Benghazi house to house with impunity, as he said he would do before the intervention? And I know you just questioned whether how imminent that may have actually been, but let's assume that it happened. Do you think that Syria and Yemen would be playing out similarly to the way they are right now if the UN Security Council had not intervened?
You know, I think President Ali Abdullah Saleh of Yemen and Bashar al-Assad of Syria are probably keeping their eyes on two already illustrated models in the Arab world. One is the one we've seen from Egypt and Tunisia, where presidents were forced to step down, and now either they or end up in exile, or their families and their ruling elites are facing trials for corruptions and so on and so forth. And then there is the Libyan model, where a leader refused to step down under popular mass pressure and protest, and ends up unleashing the worst sorts of weapons against his own people. Now, fortunately, for example, for the likes of the Yemeni President Ali Abdullah Saleh, the opposition, mature and interesting as it has been, did offer him the possibility of stepping down without any repercussions later on, without any possibility of putting him on trial, simply in as part of a reconciliation process where he and his family and his close corrupted ones step aside and a transitional government takes on and so on and so forth. Short-sighted as he is, he thus far has rejected that kind of offer. And I think we're seeing the same kind of procrastination from the Syrian president. It's just, you would just would hope that those sorts of leaders have seen what's the model of Libya that is probably going nowhere, and the problem of Egypt, that we've seen that kind of peaceful change that everyone is hopeful for, and they would learn the lessons from that. It doesn't seem that either, for the time being, at least not Ali Abdullah Saleh, has learned the lesson.
Marwan Bishara, my guest on WNYC, senior political analyst for Al Jazeera English and host of Empire, a monthly show about global powers. How do you view the rift developing within NATO nations over how aggressive to be in the war in Libya? Gaddafi forces are now winning enough battles that, in fact, today's news says another massacre of rebels is now possible in some areas, the very kind of thing that the intervention was intended to prevent. But some countries in the coalition want to be more aggressive militarily, some do not. What's your understanding of who's on what side and why?
You know, I've spoken twice over the last 4 months with the Secretary General, Andriy Fogg Rasmussen, and in the two occasions, I got the impression that he was so cautious that it was clear that he sits on no consensus whatsoever, except the sort of public displays of unity that we've seen in that so-called article that was written, presumably, by Prime Minister Cameron and President Sarkozy and President Obama, saying that we want to see a military intervention to protect the Libyan people until Gaddafi goes, which, by the way, is a wild interpretation of UN Resolution 1973. But be that as it may, I think the French has proven to be the most overzealous of all, because they're the ones who have been left out of Libya over the last 7 years. I think the British would have liked to see themselves enter into the Middle East or North African gates through Libya, knowing that this is a place that is ripe for that kind of intervention, and especially also because America's under President Obama seemed a bit less interested, more indifferent, if you will, to the changes in places like Libya. That leaves on the other side the likes of Turkey and Germany, who really didn't want to see much of this. And as you know, and your listeners probably remember, that Germany did abstain from that resolution in 1973, and the Turks were quite adamant that a political solution needs to be tried out before military intervention. So, yes, you could say among the 28, there are those who are very, very distant, like the Polish, those who are quite against, like the Turks, those who are quite passive, but against it, like the German, the overzealous, like the French, the curious and the interested, like the British, and the indifferent, but they would go along with their Western allies, like the Americans. And so, in the overall,
that's a very interesting
pushing forward.
That's a very interesting overview of and quick thumbnail overview of NATO and some of its politics. That was fascinating. Do you use the term Arab Spring? Do you think that's a good phrase?
It's the most, let's call it, safe of all. Now that it's, of course, heating up, we're seeing much of a less of a spring and more of a hot summer, because once we moved from Tunisia and Egypt, that peaceful, relatively peaceful transition, to the violent scenes that we've seen today in Yemen and Libya, of course, it's not much of a spring anymore. But I am one of those who have argued, even within Al Jazeera itself, that mass protest for mass change, for radical change, is in some way revolutionary. And you could say that the fact that this is happening across the Arab world, that there is a sense of an Arab revolution out there, whether it will succeed or not remains to be seen, whether it will lead to the kind of change, democracy, justice, and freedom for the Arab people also remains to be seen. But so far, the signs that we've seen from, as I said, Tunisia and Egypt are quite encouraging. The two autocratic ruling parties and ruling families have been put aside and put on trial, and people are marching forward. And the likes of Libya, Syria, and Yemen, we've seen complications. That doesn't bode well for a springtime, but it is a work in progress. It is, in a way, a revolution by mostly youth transformed into a popular revolution across the Arab world. There's lots of hope, but of course, for many out there, this is not a question of analysis. It's not just business. It's personal. It's personal for each and every Arab who know that their future, the future of their families, of their children, is really on the line. And hence, I think in that way, it's quite dramatic.
Absolutely. And before you go, how do you see the role of your own organization, Al Jazeera, in the democracy movements?
You know, there's been arguments about Al Jazeera, whether the so-called Al Jazeera effect, whether some even wildly speculated if the revolution would have been possible at all without Al Jazeera, considering it is the network that is watched by tens, sometimes hundreds of millions of Arabs across the region. It is the one that sort of brought back the Arabs in a sort of a pan-Arab way through language and through satellite television covering the entire region.
And largely, if I might suggest, because Al Jazeera has been so critical of these Arab dictator-led governments for a number of years now, correct?
It has been so critical that we've been closed down in almost half of the Arab world. We've been shot at. Our journalists have have been killed recently in Libya. Four have been arrested. One has been killed just over the last 6 weeks. So, it has been a voice of dissent, a controversial voice that brings together all voices of different segments of the population, and hence it has been quite opposed by Arab dictators.
But one thing from an American perspective is that I think, and you know, you tell me if you agree, hosting your show Empire about global powers, I think a lot of the critique of Arab governments by Al Jazeera has been in the context of their questionable relationships with the United States. And yet these Arab Spring democracy movements seem detached from protesting against the Americans and seem much more focused on the very local domestic politics and domestic, living conditions of the people in the countries. Would you agree with that observation?
No, I wouldn't, for two reasons. One, because some aspect of it happened by default rather than by design. Since 1991, the Al Jazeera Arabic has been established in 1995 and Al Jazeera English 5 years ago. Over the last 5 years, there have been two wars with tacit American involvement within the near Middle East and, of course, direct military intervention within Iraq and Afghanistan. And hence, the question of foreign, and we underline foreign, military occupation and intervention, whether that by the United States or its prime ally, Israel, of course has been a question of controversy, and of course that has been a major and central question for the Arab world. But but Al Jazeera has been banned and has been confronted and resisted and suppressed by America's friends and foes alike in the region.
And with that, we leave it with Marwan Bishara from Al Jazeera, senior political analyst and host of Empire, a monthly show about global powers. He joined us from London today. Thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Brian Lehrer and WNYC. Coming up next, did you hear about some people in the media getting fooled last week by a GE tax day hoax, a made-up story about GE voluntarily paying back its tax refund? Well, we have a guest from the tax reform group that punked the AP and other news organizations coming up next. And then talk about bitter herbs as the first Seder night approaches. Sean Gibby, a convert to Judaism, talks about loving the religion but getting used to the food. So stay with us.